Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 5:17 p.m. and that's I think it's called Texas time. I'm in Austin at the moment. My daughter is competing in a super youth circuit fencing tournament over the weekend, so we got in here just recently. But I saw this chart earlier on today, and of course, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I saw this chart and I thought it was really particularly graphic in terms of showing that we are in fact already in a period of modern monetary theory. You can see that, for example, the US deficit had been increasing rather significantly all the way through from about early 2017 through until about the beginning of October. Then it started to contract really rather considerably. Well, it's not so much about the deficit contracting, but rather issuance of T-bills had been increasing for the last few years, and then the Federal Reserve started buying them in October, and of course they've bought quite a lot of them. But the most important point is that the way that this is being sold is because the Federal Reserve is alarmed at the illiquidity in the repo market, and they have got really just cause for being concerned about it, because the repo market is integral to the functioning of the money markets. If you have a lockup or a bout of severe illiquidity, in the repo markets, in the money markets, then that is going to have significant knock-on effects for the banking sector, and there's just no way that they can allow that to happen. It would also have a significant effect on the ability of the Federal Reserve to control the lower bound of their interest rates. So this is not a blip. This is one of the most important points that I think is lost on not only investors but a lot of market commentators and people writing about fixed income. This is not something that is just a mistake. This is in fact a symptom of a much wider issue, and that wider issue is very closely tied to three different factors. The first is that the Federal Reserve has been running significant deficits, which means that they have a call on capital, so they're draining liquidity out of the system. Then you have an additional point that the major investment banks are not in a position to punt in the repo markets, because a lot of the liquidity that they had available to do that is now already committed to the major investment, to the purchase of US treasuries. Then you have the third point, which is that the Federal Reserve itself had been contracting the size of its balance sheet for a prolonged period of time. What that really contributed to is a trifecta of different factors that then created this illiquid situation within the repo markets. And now they are racing to try and ensure that there is enough of money in the financial system to, I think, and if we go back and think about central banking policy 101, their number one job, the thing that they have to do every single day of the year is ensure that there is enough of liquidity in the markets to promote a growth environment. That means that when we think about the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the acute response they've had to the repo issue, well, it's no exaggeration to say that this has been a panicky response. They have gone from 3.75 trillion to 4.13 in the space of a little more than 3 months. And that's a profound change relative to the pace of decline. If we think about it, they started, I think, getting serious about contracting the size of the balance sheet at the beginning of 2018. And they took it from about 4.4 trillion down to 3.75. And in the space of 3 months, they have reversed more than half it. And that is just the beginning. Again, this is another thing that the Federal Reserve has been very clear not to state, but I think the market can pretty much understand that what we now have from the Federal Reserve is a standing repo facility. And that is unlimited liability for the Federal Reserve. It means that the size of the balance sheet could go significantly higher from where we are today. Because what this now effectively means is the Federal Reserve is on the hook for the repo requirements of the entire world. And that means we are likely to see the size of the balance sheet exceed $4.5 trillion within the year and potentially move significantly higher. I think it is the only other central bank, and again, this is a point I've been making now for what really feels like a long time, but the only central bank globally that has had any experience with taking a significant quantity of liquidity out of circulation is the ECB. And the repercussions of that were deflation, a massive growth scare, and what they eventually ended up doing was putting in 2.5 times more than they took out. Well, what that suggests is that if the Federal Reserve took $750 billion out of circulation, it could potentially, if it's going to be anything even remotely close to what the ECB did, then they're going to have to put in 2.25. That's going to take the size of the balance sheet up to $6 trillion. And that's before we even begin to think about the threat from a recession. All of this action is in fact designed to ensure that we don't get a recession. This is a massive source of additional liquidity that we are really on the cusp of beginning to get. Now, when we look at the size of the ECB's balance sheet, it's also increasing, but they're only doing about $20 billion a month. And that means nothing when we look at the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet going up well in excess of $300 billion in the space of 3 months. That's more than 5 times the quantity of money that the ECB is putting in on a monthly basis. And little wonder then that the dollar has had a little bit of a wobble over the course of the last while. Now, the euro was in negative territory in here today, and the dollar had the euro had got up to test the region of its trend mean over the course of December so far. Europe does not want a stronger currency. Their growth is significantly lower than the USA's. And they have a clear incentive to try and reduce the value of the currency in order to stimulate growth and also to stimulate exports. The reliance of Europe on exports is significantly more than the USA, at least in the physical capacity. If we were to strip out the services sector from the USA, then they don't have nearly the same reliance on exports that the EU does when we think about machinery and engineering equipment and the automotive sector, or indeed luxury goods for that matter. Then Europe is far more reliant on those sectors than the USA is. And of course, it doesn't have a dynamic, homogeneous internal market either. I will give you a very clear example of that. When Mrs. Tracy started doing business in on Amazon in the USA. You simply set up the account and you are up and trading within about 4 hours. When you want to start selling in Europe, you have to be incredibly careful about where you decide to send your inventory. You need to register a company, you need to register for VAT. You basically need to employ a customs broker and a VAT broker unless you want to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to consolidate VAT. What it also means is it's a significant additional cost. The bigger your business gets, then you would have to register for VAT in all of the different European countries. The smaller your business is, you can manage it from the UK. The bigger it gets, and the greater the demand for your products, the more cost that becomes a factor. That's equally the case in incidentally in Canada. When somebody from the US wants to open a business in Canada, then they are responsible to each of the individual provinces for sales tax on each one of those on each one, in each sale within Canada, regardless of the fact that those sales are conducted over Amazon. But that's just a simple example of the ease of doing business. And what it also suggests is that Europe still has an awfully long way to go in terms of attempting to create a homogeneous market. And they are an awfully long way from achieving that, particularly when we talk about the about a homogeneous market really does require some kind of homogeneous taxation system. Well, obviously, the federalists within Europe are certainly heading in that direction. And when we think about the European stock market, then it has been pushing on the upside. The Euro Stoxx index broke up and out of a 5-year range this week. When we look at this on a longer term basis, then it has been ranging below the 400 level for most of the last decade and below 450 for the last 20 years. So if it can push back up towards that 450 level, I think it has the potential to keep going. Because the one thing we can say now that was not true back in 2007 and in 2000 is that the market does look better supported after ranging for 5 years below 400 for a run back towards the 450 level. And Europe has a greater need for a weaker currency. But when we think about what is going on in terms of the US, I thought it was also particularly interesting. I've been traveling a lot recently. I'm in Texas now. I was in Florida last week and I was in Denver 3 weeks ago. What is abundantly clear from talking to various Uber drivers and people in hotels and people I meet around is the US economy is booming. Anyone who wants a job has a job. And more to the point, there is competition for workers. The S&P 500 is extending this advance. We are getting monetary and fiscal stimulus simultaneously at a time when the economy is booming. And that is quite likely to result in bubbly activity. It's been my view for most of the last decade that this liquidity-fueled environment would persist until we get bubble valuations. Now, when we go back and think about the repercussions of the move that is now quite clearly in evidence, that we already have modern monetary theory. In fact, I think it is a misconstruence of what it means to say that we've never had it before. We've had plenty of examples previously where there has been a clear coordination between the monetary and fiscal authorities. The US presidential cycle is the perfect example of that. And anyone who's a student of market history is familiar with the fact that the incumbent party attempts to prime the pump ahead of the next election. So they start deficit spending, priming the pump in terms of handing out goodies to the people that support them, and trying to sway public opinion by lowering taxes. They start that usually in the third year. Then you start to get the stock market doing better in the second half of the third year, because usually the excuse that is presented is a growth scare in the first half of the third year of the presidential cycle. Well, we've just gone through that. We had a growth scare at the beginning of this year. We have had three interest rate cuts. We've had we're now in trillion-dollar deficits, and there is a clear effort underway to remove some of the headwinds to growth and remove some of the things that people were worried about, which is basically agreeing to a hiatus in the trade war. So far, it doesn't look like it's anything more than that. But what it does suggest is we're not going to get additional rate hikes this year. We are unlikely to see an intensification of the trade war. And that is quite normal. Generally speaking, the fourth year of the US presidential cycle is the best. Now, when we look at market history, and look at a year like 2019, which on paper has been really very impressive on the upside. If we look at the performance of the stock market, just on a currency adjusted basis, the S&P 500 is up 28%. The only market that's up more than that is the CSI 300 in China. But they're both benefiting from the calendar effect. That there was a significant sell-off at the end of 2018. Every market, though, is in the positive this year on a currency-adjusted basis. Usually, when the S&P 500 is up 28% in a year, then the following year is also positive, but usually not as positive. Now, when we then think about the fourth year of the presidential cycle, well, that usually suggests that the fourth year is in fact better than the third year. But the other point is that the market is becoming really quite overextended. The greatest consistency characteristic of this trend that's been underway now for nearly a decade has been the tendency of the market to go sideways for up to a year and a half, then break out, pull back to the region of the trend mean, and then engage in an incredibly persistent advance until we get the next inconsistency and period of ranging. Then it broke out again, moved to a new high, pulled back to the region of the trend mean, and then engaged in a very persistent advance all the way up to the next period of inconsistency. Well, we had it breaking out to a new all-time high in July. It came back to the region of the trend mean, and now it is pushing on the upside. This is also very much in line with the Santa Claus rally. Generally speaking, at the end of November, around the Thanksgiving Day holiday, investors start buying in advance of the Christmas rally. There is some tax selling that goes on in order to, one is to maximize the loss so that, or take best advantage of the loss would probably be the best way to think about it, in order to write it off against profits. There is the additional point that investors or fund managers and asset managers don't really want to have the worst performing share in their portfolio at the end of the year. There's going to be a lot of client meetings at the beginning of January, so they don't want to be seen to hold the worst performing share of the year, so they also sell it. They then are under pressure as well. When we think about what this year held, if one wasn't really very on the ball at the beginning of January last year, they would have missed out on a very sharp rally up, right back up to the peak. It took about 10 weeks for the market to decline just under 20% on a closing basis. It was more than 20% on an intraday basis, and it took 3 months to recoup the entire decline. Well, if someone was only coming into the market at the end of March, then the market hasn't gone up that much. But it has been extending its advance over the course of the last few weeks. What this looks like is a consistent trend that we have had a series of ranges, and each of the ranges has been resolved with a clear upward break. Well, then it becomes really easy to analyze, because when we just look at the chart, then what we're presented with is a series of ranges, one above another. Each of the ranges is resolved on the upside with a clear upward break, that then we don't see the price coming back down into the range. And that means that as long as the breakout is sustained on the S&P 500, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, I think then it is also worth looking at what happens after an inverted yield curve. We had a very mild inversion of the yield curve, really only for a few days in right at the end of August. And since then, the yield curve has been steepening, but it hasn't been steepening in a dramatic fashion. In fact, it's only now back to where it was trading back in May. Well, when we look at what happened at various other inversions of the yield curve, then what we can see is that after the initial inversion in 1998, the spread did get up above 50 basis points, but came straight back down again, went sideways for the next almost a year and a half, and then became even more inverted in 2000. Then we had dramatic easing, and they don't usually implement dramatic easing until well into a bear market cycle. And then prices really did start to contract, but between 1998 and the eventual peak in the stock market, it went up 50%. Then we had the inversion in 2005, and by the time the market peaked in 2007, it had gone up another 30%. So now let's think about the inversion in August. And how much has the market gone up since then? Well, the inversion was around the for the sake of argument, think about it being around 2830. So the market has gone up 400 points since then. So we're talking about a seventh, and I think that is still modest relative to the kinds of moves on the upside we've had following other inversions. The most important thing about an inverted yield curve is that it is a reliable indicator of a future recession. But it has such a long tail that the immediate response to the environment that's evolving is for central banks to ease some policy. And that encourages people to re-engage. And we see the market rallying from there. Now, when we think about what's going on out there in the wider world, then there is obviously a clear demand for easier monetary policy. There has been the rise of populism. That rise in populism did not occur by accident. It occurred because of some very real reasons. that large numbers of people were effectively disenfranchised by the rollout of globalization. There was no real consideration given to what kinds of jobs would replace manufacturing. The most important point about manufacturing jobs is that they do tend to pay better because they're more volatile. Then the jobs that actually pay best are in the mining sector and in extractive resources, whether that is mining or timber, or indeed in the oil sector. Now, when we think about the mining sector, a lot of the jobs that were concentrated in the mining sector in the Western world was in coal. So a lot of those communities have been denuded of their jobs. The manufacturing sector has essentially evaporated. The one thing that manufacturing and the extractive sectors have in common is that they do not require a high degree of education. In other words, they were the primary routes for less well-educated people to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And they have now basically been contracting for more than 20 years. And that is, I think, the primary reason why we are now seeing an uptick in populism, because there are literally millions of people who have been disaffected. The kinds of jobs that have replaced been relied upon to replace the manufacturing and extractive jobs have been primarily in low-end services. And low-end services tend to have the lowest wages. So what is in fact happening is very simple. The route to which, or the route that people have relied on for upwards of 100 years to achieve a middle-class lifestyle has been replaced with jobs where it is almost impossible to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And that is obviously a really significant factor in the rise of populism. So politicians are now responding. And austerity is just no longer defensible. There is just no way that they can continue with austerity. The size of central bank balance sheets are going to expand. Deficits are going to be increased. And this is not a short-term factor. In fact, the reason why the Labour Party had such a crushing defeat in the UK election is because they tried to compete with the Conservatives on fiscal laxity, and their promises were so extravagant that they weren't even credible. But there was nobody preaching about the need for fiscal conservatism. Fiscal conservatism is certainly not something that is going to win an election anywhere. What this means is we are being presented with an environment which is incredibly liquidity rich. The big question that we needed answered at the beginning of this year was, where are the additional sources of liquidity going to come from? Now we have our answer. We have abundant liquidity being produced by the Federal Reserve. We have the ECB also engaged in quantitative easing. There is nobody raising interest rates, although the Riksbank in Sweden this week did move from negative to zero. But the broader point is that this has been a liquidity-fueled bull market, and we are seeing new sources of liquidity evolving. Now, when we then think about China, I think there is a lot going on under the surface. can see that the stock market there put in all of its advance for the year in the first couple of months of 2019 and has been doing nothing since then. But back in 2016, the central banker in China was talking about a Minsky moment and the threat of a Minsky moment. A Minsky moment can simply be defined as when the market loses faith in the ability of prices to reflect value, and it then results in a massive haircut to asset prices. China's debt burden has increased very considerably in the last decade, and this is the primary reason why the country has been able to achieve a growth rate that was competitive with other emerging markets, regardless of the size of the economy. It's been able to grow at 7 and 8%, although that growth rate is now contracting. It's at 6%. We have Xi Jinping very clearly telling the population that they need to tighten their belts and that there are harder times coming. Then we have the fact that the growth in the economy is contracting and that defaults are rising. Well, defaults are rising on the one hand because the government is allowing them to rise. They never allowed defaults before, and now they are. Now, I did see a rather interesting graphic in here today, and I think it is really instructive that when we look at companies listed on the NYSE, we get a really quite useful bell curve of those that make money and those that lose money. And then if we look at the same factor on mainland listed companies in China, then there are almost no companies that report a loss. And all companies then have some form of profit. And of course, that's a logical impossibility. There are always going to be some companies that do better than others. Well, when we then think about stock market valuations, the CSI 300 has a PE of about 14 and yields about 2%. So it is trading at a significant discount to, for example, the S&P 500. But this valuation is actually significantly above where it used to be. Then we look at Russia, then their valuation is at 6. Personally, I would be much swifter to compare China with Russia in terms of the trajectory of governance than with the USA. There is absolutely no doubt that with S&P 500 PE ratios at 21 and 22, that we are already in an environment which is highly dependent on additional liquidity hitting the market to support asset prices. But what I think is less well understood is that China is in a very similar situation. They have completely dependent on debt to support asset prices over the course of the last decade. Because of those fears of a Minsky moment 3 years ago, they have been trying to unwind some of their reliance on debt. But what we have since seen, and quite recently, is that now the supply of dollar bonds from Chinese issuers has started to increase once more. They cut that off about 18 months ago because in the space of 6 months, it went from zero to $450 billion. So the appetite for capital in China is voracious by any description. And that's not something that is sustainable either. What that also suggests is if we start to tie various themes together, that China has been heavily reliant on its infrastructure and export oriented business model for the last 40 years. That is now coming under threat, both because wages have increased, so they are pricing themselves out of low-end manufacturing, and in fact, because they don't have the same number of young people either. They're not quite able to compete in that sector. They're also trying to move up the value chain and create a domestic services business model similar to what Europe and the USA has, and having the additional aim of trying to offer some hedge for the Chinese economy rather than being totally reliant on the global economy. But the issue with that is the kind of control that is now being tried, the central government is trying to exert on the domestic population. With that kind of uncertainty, then that is something that is probably going to have an impact on consumer demand. And there are clear efforts underway to try and ensure that there isn't a flood of money leaving the country. I've been in a number of meetings over the course of the last 4 or 5 months with Chinese investors who have been extraordinarily eager to get their money out of China. And I thought that is both a new development in terms of the fact that I hadn't been having these conversations previously. It's also rather notable when we start to talk about the kinds of sums that people are moving, because it isn't in the hundreds of thousands or millions, but people are talking about moving billions out of China. When one goes to the bank in China today, it's extraordinarily difficult to move money even to Hong Kong, regardless of what your ambition for that cash is. So China has the one, they understand that the one big risk they have is capital flight. The only possible way that they can manage the deflation of the debt bubble that has arisen in China is to control capital within the country. And that means avoiding capital flight at all costs. So that only means that the strictures on money leaving the country are going to increase considerably as we progress. Now, the renminbi is continuing to hold around this 7 area. It spent part of last week stronger than 7, and it closed out this week just around the 7 level. I really don't think we're going to see the renminbi strengthening through the 200-day moving average. Now, when we think about all this liquidity that is getting printed, and the fact that governments and central banks are thrashing their currencies, then the fact that we haven't seen a lot of volatility in the primary pairs, where like the euro dollar or renminbi dollar, is representative of the fact that they're all doing exactly the same thing. What we are starting to see, however, is that some of the emerging market currencies, and particularly the commodity currencies, are strengthening up. And the South African rand is now trading stronger than its 200-day moving average. If it can sustain a move through 14, well, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment, and it will have broken its sequence of lower rally highs. The Brazilian real had been looking rather ropey, and it is now right in the region of its trend mean. The Bolsonaro government does not want a strong currency, and it will need to strengthen through the 4 level in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance, but at least it is steadying in here. The Australian dollar has been trending downwards for a pretty significant period of time, and now it is also right in the region of its trend mean and closed out this week at exactly 69, corresponding with the region of the trend mean. But it is gold which is the barometer against which the value of fiat currencies is measured. And gold prices have been in this rather steady period of consolidation for most of the last few months. But when we look at the longer term chart, this does not look like anything other than a simple pause and consolidation. I think it is worth highlighting that the move that we had to break the downtrend in 2016 was about 30%. The move that we had from the breakout point for up to the peak in August was about 15.75%. Now, I'm not sure whether I still have all of the data in here, but when we then look at what happened the last time, well, the breakout that we had in, I'm going to have to zoom out again, I'm afraid, and do that again. The breakout that we had all the way back in 1999 was approximately 30%. I don't know why it hasn't shown me that. If I can move this thing, it might tell me. What we can definitely see there, though, is that the percentage change was 33.69%. Now, that was meaningful, but what I find particularly interesting is that the move in 2016 was almost identical. When we then think about how big was the contraction, or how big was this breakout when we got this move up out in 2002, it was about 18%. So it was slightly larger than the one we've just had. And back in 2003, the price did come all the way back and test the region of the trend mean. Now, it has not yet done that. In fact, the pace of the decline has been much more modest on this occasion than it was back in 2003. But what I find particularly interesting is how closely the market is rhyming with the conditions that we had back in the early 2000s. Because what we also had in the 1990s was a period where technology was assumed to be the be-all and end-all, and that we were going to have companies that were going to deliver value beyond all expectations forever. And the response to that crash was to print an incredible amount of money. Well, the seismic events that we've had in terms of the political sphere have been the catalysts on this occasion. But we can't simply ignore the fact that valuations in the technology sector are increasing. That doesn't mean that it's over. What I do suspect, however, is that we are in a very favorable period right now because of the Santa Claus rally that could easily carry through to the first week of next year. But subsequent to that, we're probably going to get some consolidation. Usually when the market rallies very strongly in the last week of the year, then we do get a little bit of consolidation in the first week of the next year. But the broader picture is that we're in a liquidity-fueled environment. Eventually, we are going to see the kind of bubbly activity that's currently evident in the venture capital sector translate into a problem for pensions and a problem for private equity and a problem for investors generally. And that will have a knock-on effect. What we can also think about is that if central banks the world over are thrashing their currencies and gold is still really very steady, then we are quite likely to have an inflationary scare. Now, when we then think about the government bond markets, the 10-year Treasury yield is at 1.91%, and it is coming back up towards the region of the trend mean. But interest rates are at 1.75%. So there is no pickup in inflation. There is no pickup in the pricing of inflation, is probably the best way to describe it, over the next decade. That, to me, sounds rather risible, that when you've got a booming economy and you have commodity prices starting to increase, gold breaking out of its base formation, a condition where anyone who wants a job can find a job, and governments printing money like it was going out of fashion. What that does suggest is we are heading towards an inflation scare. And an inflationary scare is quite consistent with the potential for a bubbly environment to evolve. Oil prices, however, do continue to be relatively well contained, and the price has pushed up through the 200-day moving average this week. It is consolidating above the $65 area. Now, I continue to think that oil prices are going to be range-bound more than trending for at least the next decade. I think that there is just so much additional oil that can be brought to market. There was a lot of additional oil that was planned to be brought to market offshore that is now uneconomic. There is a lot of unconventional supply that doesn't really become economic until they can hedge around $75 or $80. So that pretty much puts a cap on how high prices can go. There is the other point that when we get secular bull markets in stocks, it generally coincides with bear markets in energy. And I do rather think that that is now what we are getting. That oil prices are likely to be in a range for I think the foreseeable future. And that gives the potential for stocks to outperform by a wide margin. Now, when we then think about how does that likely to affect gold? Well, we can have inflationary pressures without oil prices surging higher. Part of the reason that we can have that is because of tax and regulation. There's a lot of talk right now about a green bubble. But one of the most profound effects of the success of the environmental lobby in having their view on policy implemented is the creation of new taxes. And those new taxes fall primarily on oil. So the cost of oil and the cost of running energy products is increasing, regardless of the fact that oil prices are still relatively well contained. And that can have an inflationary problem, because if people can't afford to transact, then they're going to demand higher wages. And wage growth peaked around the 3.5% level in 2008. It is currently running around the 3% level. If it starts to push higher, then that is something that we would have to give due consideration to, that there is the potential for an inflationary outcome. Then, of course, when we think about where the stress might start to really manifest, well, delinquencies are obviously something that need to be paid attention to. But right now, delinquencies are pushing on to new lows. And that is also supportive of a healthy consumer. Then I think it's important to continue to monitor Amazon. Amazon has been trending downwards since July. It's been trading below the trend mean now for the last 3 months, and it needs to sustain a move back above the trend mean in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance. when we then think about some of the shares that are accelerating higher, well, AMD, this is, the wrong ticker. Advanced Micro Devices has been the best performing share this year. It has rocketed higher over the course of the last quarter. Now, when we then think about what the risks are, there is the real potential that this market is going to start coming back on the 1st of January. There is a lot of good news being priced in right now. And this is for a share that does not make a lot of profit. And its estimated PE is now around 70. Its historic PE was 190. And there is obviously a lot has to continue to go right in order to justify the accelerating price trend. Apple has also been doing phenomenally well and is accelerating by any definition of that word. So this also suggests that the first week of 2020 could give us some clear signals that these accelerating trends are starting to lose their momentum. I think that the illiquid time between Christmas and New Year is, generally speaking, some time when investors like to take punts. The other market that is potentially going to be a party to that is Bitcoin. We had an upside key reversal in Bitcoin on Wednesday. It hasn't really followed through on the upside. The primary consistency characteristic is its tendency to encounter resistance at successively lower levels in $1,000 increments on a monthly basis. It's going to have to at least push up and sustain a move through 8,000 in order to break the downtrend. There is the possibility that that's what we're going to see over the Christmas period, simply because there will be less traders around and it'll be less liquid. And I think with that, I will wish all the best to all of you.